For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. For those who are new, welcome. I'm Taigen Layton, the guiding Dharma teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. Welcome, everyone. It's my great pleasure to have giving the talk this morning of Zenshin Florence Kaplow, who's spoken at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate numbers of times before the pandemic. For those of you who do not know her, Florence is a Zen priest in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, and she's also a Unitarian Universalist minister at the church in Urbana-Champaign in southern Illinois. And she was a professional conservation biologist and botanist, and she's an environmental activist, and she has co-edited a wonderful book called Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, which also has commentaries by modern women teachers and practitioners. It's a wonderful book, a great resource on teachers from women teachers and women practitioners from many countries, and just a wonderful resource of Buddhist stories. Thank you very much for coming, Florence. And Florence is going to be talking about one of the stories from the Hidden Lamp, wonderful Hidden Lamp collection. Thank you, Florence.
Can everyone hear me all right? Good, wonderful. Well, thank you, Taigen, for that introduction. I really want to begin with a thank you to Taigen, who is an old friend. I think we first met at Green Gulch sometime about close to 20 years ago. And I've watched as Ancient Dragon Zen Gate has gone from a few students in Chicago inviting Taigen to come out and teach now and again to this beautiful flowering that continues. In these strange times, I do feel that the sanghas that have found ways to be accessible online have actually opened the Dharma in ways that really were unimaginable before, that people who live far, far away from the nearest teacher, the nearest sangha can engage with the teachings in ways that simply weren't possible before. So I know that this transition has not been easy for anyone. I know it hasn't been easy for me as a minister of a congregation, but I also know that the sparks of the Dharma are spreading far and wide because of this pandemic, ironically. So thank you for all your efforts in that way. And I just want to start with a few words about the Hidden Lamp. Most of you, I'll bet, know this, but just in case there's someone who is not so familiar with it, I've been practicing the Dharma, Actually, I said 20 years. It's closer to 30, Taigen, because it's actually, anyway, a long time, a while. And I noticed, as of course anyone paying attention would notice, that the teachings primarily took a male form. And so in about 2010, I started collecting koans and stories about women, and then invited my wonderful Dharma sister, Sue Moon, to join me, writer, editor, and we worked on this book, this is The Hidden Lamp, for several years. It came out in 2013, and I'm happy to say that it feels like these stories and koans are now really entering, have fully entered the Dharma realm in many, many ways. And that's wonderful. And I love teaching from it. There's so much wisdom and richness in each of these stories. And every time I encounter one of these stories, new facets come forward for me. When Taigen approached me about offering teaching this summer, I started thinking about, well, what would I want to teach from? And as I sat with it, what came to mind was a very particular story in The Hidden Lamp. And actually, when I was doing a little research on the various sources for the story, I discovered that one of the translators of it is Taigen Dan Leighton in Dogen's extensive record. It's one of the places where one of the sources of the story. There's a number of others, including in the Book of Serenity, and also Hakuin talks about it. So one of the great things about this story is that it's found in both the Rinzai and Soto traditions. I'm just going to start with reading the whole thing to you. So there's something kind of wonderful about being read a story. So bring your child's mind and listen to a story for a moment. Seven wise sisters planned a spring journey. One of them said, "Sisters, instead of going to a park to enjoy the spring flowers, let's go together to see the charnel grounds." The other said, "That place is full of decaying corpses. What is such a place good for?" The first woman replied, "Let's just go. Very good things are there." When they arrived, one of them pointed to a corpse and said, "There is a person's body. Where has the person gone?" "What?" another said. "What did you say?" And all seven sisters were immediately enlightened. Indra, Lord of the gods, was moved by their awakening and showered flowers down upon them. He offered them whatever they needed for the rest of their lives. One of the sisters replied, "We have everything we need, but please give us a tree without roots, some land without light or shade, and a mountain valley where a shout does not echo." "Ask anything else, holy ladies," replied Indra, "and I will gladly provide it, but I don't have those things to give you." "If you don't have them," said the woman, "how can you help others liberate themselves?" At this, Indra took the sisters to visit the Buddha. When the Buddha learned why they had come, he said, "As far as that's concerned, Indra, none of the arhats have the slightest clue either. Only great bodhisattvas understand this matter." So, these seven wise women in the charnel ground, why in the world would I have chosen this for today? Most of the commentaries on this story focus on the second half of the story. Dogen does in his extensive record, which I have to admit, Taigen, every time I say that, when I first bought it, I was a really poor itinerant monk and I couldn't help it. I had to have it, but I referred to it as Dogen's extensive record. It was such a major purchase for me. So in Dogen's expensive record, and actually also in Bani Myotai Treece's reflection on this story in The Hidden Lamp, both of them really focus on the second half of the story. And I'm going to take the liberty of ignoring the second half of the story, because I think there's so much for us in the first half of the story. So I'm just going to read the part that I'm going to be mostly exploring again, so you can hear it again. Seven wise sisters planned a spring journey. One of them said, "Sisters, instead of going to a park to enjoy the spring flowers, let's go together to see the charnel grounds." The others said, "That place is full of decaying corpses. What is such a place good for?" The first woman replied, "Let's just go. Very good things are there." So in my mind anyway, these are maybe slightly aristocratic women who would have the leisure to go on a spring outing together. And they go to the charnel ground. For those of you who might not be familiar with charnel ground practice, it goes all the way back to the early Theravadan practitioners in India and also later in Tibet, to this day in Tibet. Bodies would be laid out in an open space away from habitation to decay on their own, to be eaten by animals, by jackals, by hyenas, by vultures, torn apart. And from the earliest times of the Buddha, powerful practice was to go to the charnel grounds, which, remember, are not just full of decaying bodies, but actually also full of wild animals, dangerous wild animals, and practice zazen there, practice meditation there, meditating on the impermanence of the body. Honestly, it was in the Tibetan, within the Theravadan practice, also meditating on the loathsomeness of the body to release attachments, the sensual desire, to release attachments to returning again and again into a human body. There are contemporary Theravadan practitioners who do this practice. I remember hearing a while ago about a Western practitioner, I don't remember all the details on this, but basically who donated his body to be used for an online charnel ground practice. So basically a camera on his body as it decayed. And that might seem shocking to us. I think even in ancient India, the charnel ground was not a place that people wanted to go. It was a place of fierce and unflinching practice, of great courage. And my understanding is that in the Mahayana turning of the wheel, although charnel ground practice, as I said, continues in Tibet and other Vajrayana areas to this day, the focus changed. And the understanding was that the charnel ground was a place of great liberation, great possibility of liberation. And I thought it's interesting. I found a reading, some writing by Roshi Joan Halifax about visiting a charnel ground near Mount Kailash in Tibet. And I noticed when I excerpted it that I actually could not read the full description, which says something about my own willingness to even fully encounter some of this. It's in her book, Standing on the Edge, if you want to go read it yourself. But I'll just read this little section. Every time I've traveled to Mount Kailash in Western Tibet, this is one of the most important areas of pilgrimage in within the Vajrayana universe, believed to be center of the world. I've climbed up to the Dakini charnel ground. And Dakinis, by the way, are enlightened women. A barren, rocky plateau above the trail on the western side of the mountain. This is the place where dead bodies are offered in a practice known as sky burial, or in Tibetan, jator, scattering to the birds. There I have practiced walking meditation among piles of bones and pools of blood, fat, and feces. The stench is rancid, even in the cold wind, and I could hear the flap of vulture wings and howls of jackal close by. And she goes on to say, we don't have to go to Tibet or into a war zone to practice in a charnel ground. The charnel ground is a metaphor for any environment where suffering is present. A Japanese hospital, a schoolroom, a violent home, a mental institution, a homeless shelter, a refugee camp. Even a space of privilege like the corporate boardroom or Wall Street trading floor can be a charnel ground. Really, any place that is tainted by fear, depression, anger, despair, disrespect, or deceit is a charnel ground, including our own mind. I might say, especially our own mind. All those qualities that she described are not inherent to the charnel ground itself. They're what arise in our own mind in response to it. Maybe it's already clear why I wanted to bring up this koan today. Because we are living in eternal ground right now. Each one of us, each and every one of us. We have COVID. And if you have read, which I have, some of the descriptions written by emergency room doctors in COVID hotspots, it is the description, the very description of a charnel ground. As part of my training for ministry, I spent 3 months, only 3 months, doing what's called clinical pastoral education in a hospital setting. Many of you, some of you may have had that experience as chaplains. And I have to say, I think charnel grounds in general are a hospital, or hospitals are in general charnel grounds. As sanitized in some way as they are, there is no hiding from the indignities and in some cases horrors of the breaking down of the human body. A lot of us in our lives, in our daily lives, can pretty much ignore this. Most of us are not getting up every day and going to an emergency room, going to the hospital. Our bodies can continue to function sometimes for decades without major troubles. But COVID brings it all really close to home. I think at this point, it would be hard to be an American and not know someone or know someone whose close family member has been affected by COVID or has died of it. We're living sequestered in our houses. Many of us, both of us, and there's really no end in sight. This is one of the realities of the charnel ground of this time. The second reality that has become exquisitely and painfully clear, that really should have been all along, but again, our powers of denial are extraordinary, is systemic racism, with the horrific murder of George Floyd live on Facebook, filmed by an extraordinarily courageous 17-year-old girl. The extraordinary thing really about the charnel ground systemic racism is how obvious it's been all along and how long it's taken for the country as a whole to wake up to it. A friend of mine who is a African-American Unitarian Universalist minister shared with me that she had recently come across what Thomas Jefferson wrote in his Notes on Virginia, which is a compendium of all the characteristics of the of Virginia at his time: the plants, the animals, the topography, the form of government, all of it very rational, very Enlightenment era writing. Until he gets to where he talks about African slaves. And then all of that Enlightenment clarity goes out the window. And again, I'm not going to read it to you. You can find it yourself online. But he actually talks about Black women being attractive and mating with orangutans. And that's just the start. And of course, this was a man who is the founding father of our country and had hundreds of slaves himself. And in fact, we don't know whether it was with or without her consent, but she could not give consent as a slave, became sexually and romantically involved with a 14-year-old girl, Sally Hemings, and had six children with her. She was pregnant. That's our founding father. As I was thinking about this talk, I was walking around my neighborhood, and I live in a beautiful old neighborhood, very neighborly in Champaign-Urbana. And a lot of people have these little libraries on their front lawns. And I walked by one and opened it up, and I noticed this book called Our America, Life and Death on the South Side of Chicago. I assume that most of the people listening right now are people who live somewhere around Chicago. So this is your city. And this is a pretty incredible book. It was first published in 1997. And it's the words of Leigh Allen Jones and Lloyd Newman, who were 13 years old at the time the book began. Two boys growing up on the South Side of Chicago, describing firsthand their experiences, and with photographs by John Brooks, another young African-American boy who has incredible eye for photography. So I sat there on somebody's lawn reading this book, and then brought it home and realized that I wanted to share the end of it with you, which is simply called Our America. And it's written by Leigh Allen Jones. I'm just going to, it's a little bit of a long reading, but I want to share it with you. I think it's really important. So I didn't say this before I started in listing our areas of charnel ground practice. This turning towards the charnel ground, instead of going to look at the spring flowers, as was recommended by one of the sisters, is the first step towards really knowing and being in direct contact with what is. Everything in us wants to turn away. And yet, awakening, liberation, and transformation, including societal transformation, must start with our willingness to sit with, to breathe with what is. So as you're listening to this, please listen with the mind of Zazen. Bring your breath and your body and your awareness together, and allow these words to come into your heart, these words of a man from your own city. Well, I think at the time he wrote this, I think he was 17 by this point. Hello, this is Leigh-Allen Jones with the last chapter. It's November 19th, 1996, and I want to leave you with some final words about our America. We live in two different Americas. In the ghetto, our laws are totally different, our language is totally different, and our lives are totally different. I've never felt American. I've only felt African American. An American is supposed to have life, liberty, prosperity, and happiness. But an African American is due pain, poverty, stress, and anxiety. As an African American, I've experienced beautiful things, but the majority of the things I've experienced are not beautiful. The charnel ground. And I don't even have it as bad as most. There are millions of young men and women living the struggle even harder than me. As children, they have to make day-to-day decisions about whether to go to school or whether to go on the corner and sell drugs. As children, they know that there may not be a tomorrow. Why are African-American children faced with this dilemma at such an early age? Why must they look down the road to a future they might never see? What have my people done to this country to deserve this? And yet I am supposed to feel American. I am supposed to be patriotic. I am supposed to love the system that has been detrimental to the lives of my people. It's hard for me to say how I'm an American when I live in a second America, an America that doesn't wave the red, white, and blue flag with 50 stars for 50 states. I live in a community that waves a white flag because we have almost given up. I live in a community where on the walls are the names of fallen comrades of war. I live in a second America. I live here not because I chose to, but because I have to. I hate to sound militant, but this is the way I feel. I wonder sometimes, why am I alive? What is my purpose? And I can always find a reason. But for a kid whose mother is a crack addict and who doesn't have a father and doesn't have a meal at night and has holes in his shoes when he walks the streets and can barely read and can barely communicate his feelings, which is almost the usual characteristics of a child from the ghetto, when he asks himself the question, what is my reason for being? What is my purpose? What can he tell himself? These are the thoughts that go on in my mind and really mesmerize me. Some people might look at me and say, he's just some little nigger from the ghetto that knows some big words. Well, true, that might be. But listen to what I'm saying. I know you don't want to hear about the pain and suffering that goes on in that part of the city. I know you don't want to hear about the kids getting shot in that part of the city. But little do you know that that part of the city is your part of the city too. This is our neighborhood, this is our city, and this is our America. And we must somehow find a way to help one another. We must come together, no matter what you believe in, no matter how you look, and find some concrete solutions to the problems of the ghetto. Right now, we are at a point of no return. We've got to make a change, because if we don't, we'll go into the millennium in total disarray. But I believe it's going to be all right. Somehow, some way, I believe in my heart that we can make this happen. Not me by myself, not you by yourself. I'm talking about all of us as one, living together in our America. This is Leigh-Allen Jones on November 19th, 1996. I hope I survive. I hope I survive. I hope I survive. Signing off. Peace. I had to look up what had happened to Leigh Allen Jones. Maybe some of you know this about him. He is an American journalist. He still lives in Chicago's South Side. His radio documentaries have received critical acclaim and numerous awards. Jones was the Green Party's 2010 nominee for United States Senate from Illinois. He made it. He survived. That's systemic racism, the kernel ground of systemic racism. Then we have the charnel ground of climate change. I work closely with two Zen practitioners in Australia. So I heard about their experiences of the fires in Australia last year, which is a start to what we know is coming for the world. And finally, the rise of authoritarianism that we see not just in our own country, although it is painfully clear in our own country, but of course across the world. And it's no accident that the most authoritarian countries are the ones where COVID is rampant, including our own country. So, how do we practice in these charnel grounds? These charnel grounds that we, at this point, can't choose, like the Seven Sisters, to enter or not enter. We're in them. We're living inside them. We are living inside a charnel ground. How do we practice there? So the most important thing I would say, and the hardest, is that denial, whether in our own hearts or in our culture, does no one any good when you're living in the middle of a charnel ground. And so as hard as it is, as much as we might rather go look at the spring flowers. And by the way, I am a big advocate of looking at spring flowers. I don't think it's an either or. So one day, charnel ground, next day, spring flowers, then back to the charnel ground, then the spring flowers. Because if all you do is look at the charnel ground, you might forget about the spring flowers. I'm not saying it's all or nothing, but I am saying that our deep, deep denial around all these things doesn't make it better. It really makes it worse. And so that's the great gift of our practice, the stability and the courage that comes from Dharma practice, that comes to anybody who's sat a sesshin where you sit there for hours and hours and your legs hurt and your back hurts and you're bored and you're hot and you don't know why you're there and you keep sitting and turning the light inward. That development of that willingness to stay, that willingness to look and experience your own life, that is exactly the training for the charnel ground. And so if you ever wonder, I do believe very much the kind of Soto understanding that we sit zazen for the sheer joy of the practice mind of the Buddha that's right there in every moment of zazen. But zazen is also a training. And if there's ever a time we have needed people to train to be able to wake up in the middle of difficulty and suffering, right now. So don't think that your zazen practice is a luxury. Your zazen practice is a benefit for the whole world, now more than ever. I found some interesting reflections on these practices. Lion's Roar in April this year did a article where they brought together some practices by Pema Chodron and some practices by Bernie Glassman, late Bernie Glassman Roshi. And I thought that they were a really interesting way to think about how to practice at the time. So and first is a quote from Bernie, and then there's a quote from Emma. Whatever ideas people have of what's going to happen when they go out, and here he's referring to his sesshins of bearing witness in Auschwitz or on the streets of New York, they're wrong. And what they learn will be from the unknown. I think charnel ground practices are very similar. And then Pema goes on to say, a charnel ground here is a traditional Tibetan idea of a graveyard where, because the earth is frozen, bodies are left out in the open to be eaten by vultures. Tibetan Buddhists use the image of the charnel ground as a metaphor for the harsh reality of human life. It smells, it bleeds, it is full of unpredictability, but at the same time, it is self-radiant wisdom. The charnel ground of our ordinary life, says Pema, is the working basis for attaining enlightenment. And then she goes on to say, times are difficult globally. Awakening is no longer a luxury or an ideal. It's becoming critical. So I was interested to see that for both of them, the first step one is to let go of concepts, to go back to the simplicity and immediacy of the breath. Meditation practice is how we stop fighting with ourselves, how we stop struggling with circumstances, emotions, or mood. Whatever arises, we can look at it with a non-judgmental attitude. This instruction applies to working with unpleasantness in its myriad guises. Whatever or whoever arises, train again and again in looking at it and seeing it for what it is, without calling it names, without hurling rocks, without averting your eyes. Let all those stories go. The innermost essence of mind is without bias. Things arise and things dissolve forever and ever. That's just the way it is. The Tibetan yogini Machig Labdrung was the one who fearlessly trained with this view. She said that in her tradition, they did not exercise demons. They treated them with compassion. The advice she was given by her teacher and passed on to her students was, approach what you find repulsive, help the ones you think you cannot help, and go to places that scare you. This begins when we sit down to meditate and practice not struggling with our own mind. And then Bernie Glassman, in this same section on sort of not knowing, for me, part of the state of not knowing is entering into the worlds I am afraid of, entering into worlds about which I have no idea. I'm drawn to those aspects of myself that I do not understand, that I fear, that are a mystery. I'm drawn to enter that realm. And again, if there was ever a time in the world where we know that we do not know, it's right now. We do not know where this is all going or where it's going to end. But help the ones you cannot help and go to the places that scare you right in the middle of this time. And Roshi Bernie Glassman was most well known for this practice of bearing witness, which is to sit with the situation at hand, to bear witness to it. and to respect what is there, to regard whatever arises as the manifestation of awakened energy. The chaos in here and the chaos out there is basic energy, the play of wisdom. Whether we regard our situation as heaven or as hell depends on our perception. So when those seven sisters went to the charnel ground, they all woke up. And they didn't need anything anymore. Think about all the things that we need, that we think we need. They'd seen into the nature of things. And from that place, they could go back into the world and help. I'm often struck when I see images of Green Tara, that she has one leg tucked under her in the position of meditation, and one leg out in front, stepping into the world to be of service, to be of help. And I think that that mudra of the body is, in fact, what we are all called to do at this time. If we do just one, if we try to use meditation practice to avert or avoid the reality of the suffering of this time, then we are lost in emptiness. If we step forward with both feet and try to save everything and lose track of that powerful training in the vastness of reality, then we're lost in another way. That's our work as practitioners right now, to sit, to bear witness, and to help in whatever way we can. In that quote that I read from the end of Our America, where he says, "What am I here for?" I wish we all asked ourselves that question a little more often. What are you here for? We were all born into this time of the charnel grounds. So how are we going to live? How are we going to practice? Wake up and let our hearts be broken open right in the middle of this time. That's our work. I want to close here, and then we'll have some time for conversation. As I was looking up, I had remembered that Bonnie Myotai Treece had written a commentary on the Seven Sisters before we were working on the book, and I wanted to look at that commentary as I was looking her up online. And I discovered a more recent small piece of writing by her that I thought might be helpful to you. So I want to share it with you. It is Three Small Practices for a Time of COVID. So the first, one small practice, Basho Mind. Someone approaches you and you need them not to get closer. There will be a flicker of fear or anxiety. Exhale. Say, please stop there, and bring your hands palm to palm into Gassho, the mudra of intimacy. Smile and meet their eyes warmly. Let yourself feel their vulnerability along with your own. It is okay to take care of yourself in this and other ways. Even more important, don't let fear close your heart. Another small practice. we are the right Sangha, the right community for this challenge. Every day, find a way, big or small, to show care for one another. At least one, every day. Each of us will, as always, have different opportunities, vulnerabilities, capacities. Elders and the ill have wisdom and patience, given long experience with loss, resilience, and how attitude is everything. Offer these lovingly. Write the note, whisper the word, etc., ad infinitum. Those younger and able have energy, chances to be creative in how they serve, the quickness to see what needs changing. Offer these every day. Clean, garden, cook, write innovative programs, create the next world. Let's just start and shift from self-preoccupation to the activities of Bodhisattva. Third, memorial mind. Grief is coming, is here, will be here. Make space and time for it. Love, appreciation, reflection, sorrow. You will need to sit quietly and let these happen. We need to be real, are capable of being real, are called on to be real. So for at least 5 minutes, let grief in, let it have its way. There are doctors, nurses, caregivers dying right now for their patients, for us. Moms have died, dads, beloveds in every country, and there will be millions upon millions more. To be real is to feel this. Otherwise, we are in denial. I will not forget you. Set a timer if you need to, something to call you back. Exhale, feel your breath. Be where you are. Vow to not take the people around you or gone from you for granted. And remember that the Buddha, at the end of the story of the seven wise sisters, refers to them as great bodhisattvas. And each and every one of you, I've had the screen on gallery view, each and every one of you are great bodhisattvas. Truly, you would not be here. You would not be engaged in this practice at this time if that was not true. And the world needs you. The world needs us. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Florence, for such a helpful, timely, deep talk. Now, if anyone has questions, comments, responses, for people who are visible, you can raise your hands. For people who are not, if you go to the participant button on the bottom and go to the bottom of that, there's a button to I don't see it now.
In the lower left hand corner, in the lower right hand corner, Tigan.
Yeah, to raise your hand. And I can look for that. So if you have comments, questions, responses for Florence, please let us know.
And I'd like to really think of this as a conversation because we're doing this together. So
anyone. And Ashley.
Thank you, Florence. I'd just like to say that I've never been at a Dharma talk where I both cried and felt inspired at the same time. So I'd just like to give you mad props for that.
Thank you.
So thank you so much. That's all I had. Thank you.
May it help you going forward.
And if I may, Gary, it's so great to see you. And Gary is a chaplain at Northwestern Memorial, so working every day in the COVID charnel ground. I don't know if you want to share anything about that, but I welcome you to.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
I echo Ashley's sentiments. I mean, just such a moving talk. And to Tigan's invitation there, I'm an educator and I have six students, summer interns that I'm working with right now. And I wasn't familiar with this story, so I'm just so grateful to be introduced to it. And there's just so much, such deep wisdom that's there. And so if you don't mind, I would like to borrow some of that wisdom that you've opened up for us today and pass it along with my students. I see them tomorrow. They're from so many different faith traditions and cultural backgrounds that they're coming into the hospital every day and meeting the suffering that real deep place of open-heartedness and strong back, soft front, I think is one of the ways that Roshi Halifax talks about it. I'm really grateful to be able to join with the group today and be able to hear this talk. So thank you so much.
Barry, can I ask, how have you been taking care of yourself through this time?
Well, through a lot of giving, I mean, in terms of with COVID starting in March, we did a lot of initiatives and I was able to participate a lot in doing staff support. And so that really helped me a lot just to, you know, to pass along self-compassion practices and mindfulness practices and engage those directly with staff and to be able to see within just a couple of minutes how quickly people's bodies would settle. And that's been really helpful. And I'm in a supportive environment where we do a lot of, grief work through conversation and support. So that helps to keep, I feel like, keep me pretty current. And just doing mindfulness practices and reaching out to loved ones and family. And the Zoom's been a wonderful way to go about doing that, connecting with family. So those are some of the ways that I've tried to take care of myself.
Thank you. It's interesting to hear that, in fact, the first thing that came to mind when I asked how you took care of yourself is that how helpful it was to be able to help others. The sort of little known secret, right? That's or open secret, maybe, that how much that can support you. So thank you for that teaching.
Thank you, Gary. Good, great to see you. Please come again. other questions, anyone?
It looks like David has his hand up.
Yes, David Weiner, please.
Yeah, Florence, I've asked this question many times to different people. And am I on? Yeah, I am on. Okay. And it's hard for me. My one of the first things that I lapse into is anger. Anger at our society, anger for what's going on. My daughter is in New York, and she was in and she was part of the occupation of City Hall, and she saw people batoned by the police, and she told me the other day she's become radicalized, and I feel kindred spirit with her because I feel so angry at what's going on, and yet that's the poison. That's the second poison. How can I control that anger, and how could I channel it so that it's not destructive? And that's the question I'm constantly wrestling with, constantly. And I want to know if if I seek to you as a wise teacher, what are some ways that I may be able to use that energy in a more more constructive, more helpful way? I'm like Gary. I'm also a volunteer chaplain. I haven't seen anybody because everything's on lockdown right now. But it is when I'm with people and I'm able to give to them, I come away feeling like I'm getting more. I'm getting self-care more than what I'm giving. So I understand that. But right now, that's denied to me because of the lockdown. So I just feel myself just bursting with rage. So if you would, please, if you have a comment.
Sure. And this might not be entirely conventional from a Buddhist perspective, so bear with me. First of all, I think it might be helpful to look deeply at the degree to which you are treating your anger as poison. In one of those readings that I shared today, to turn towards that which we reject in ourselves, in a way, your anger is your charnel ground, right? And what do the seven sisters say? Very good things are there. So that would be the first, you know, whenever we set up something inside ourselves that we have little respect for, we actually give it power. So to be willing to respect your anger. The fact is that anger right now is changing the world through the Black Lives Matter protests. If you want to read some powerful, powerful teachings around anger, look up the writings of Zenju Earthling Manual. In fact, maybe you could even get Taigen to invite her to speak to your Sangha. Because Zenju, who is a friend of mine, she's African American. She's the only, as far as I know, only African American woman priest in our lineage. And what she has to say about anger is really, rage actually is really, really powerful. You know, see if you can befriend that anger. And, you know, within the Tibetan tradition, they understand, you know, wrathful energies are actually energies that can help transform and wake up. I can't show you because I probably disconnect my computer if I turned it around. But I was given a incredible tanka years ago by actually a man who was a student of Darlene Cohen, who was a wild teacher, as Taigen well knows. And it's of red tara. Probably most of you have never heard of red tara. But red tara awakens through the passions themselves without rejecting any of them. So I offer that to you, red tara, and, you know, turning towards that anger as potentially transformative rather than an enemy. I hope that's a little bit helpful, David.
Thank you. How do you spell the last name of Zenju's name?
Manuel, it's, let me double check. It's either M-A-N-U-E-L or A-L.
U-E-L.
U-E-L, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Florence. And I'll just note for David, there's at least two other people from New York City here with us. And there's numbers of people from a range of places. And so thank you. And yes, be angry, David. Ming has her hand up. Ming.
If you Ming, could. I think you have to unmute. Oh, there she is. And Ming lives across the street from me. Hello, Ming. We can't hear you, though.
Ming, you have to unmute.
Oh, looks like she is unmuted. You could write your write whatever you want in chat if you're not getting through.
Does this work?
Yes, now we hear you.
Sorry about that. I wanted to speak because I felt like Florence said something that really was tremendously helpful to me. And then David's comment actually kind of crystallized it. And so I've been having trouble with Betsy DeVos. I think in a way David probably recognizes, which is I just have been, I think it's generally not good to hate people. And I've been really struggling with her. And when Florence was talking about, Florence, when you were talking about the ways in which different ways people can be lost, somehow that was really, that kind of did it for me. Because I could see, I could then see DeVos as lost, you know, and she's full of energies and desires and fears and whatever, all this, all the same stuff. And it's coming out in in that particular way. And so that was very releasing for me. And I think it's totally in line with what David was talking about, that, that this anger, you know, there, it is, there is something about being in that state, which is not good. But the compassion that gives rise to that anger, I think, or the sense of connection or care that we have with, for other people, that's really sacred. So, I guess somehow you both really moved me. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, I mean, I've thought about anger a fair amount and how I misunderstood how I should work with anger as a, especially an early Zen student, where I thought I just needed to not feel it or just push it down or certainly not express it. And what I came to understand is that at least some of the time, anger is a deep knowledge that something is wrong and people are being hurt. And to not allow that information to right. guide you in action mm-hmm. is actually off base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
If I may, I'll just add that our precept about anger says to not harbor ill will. So that doesn't mean not to get angry and not to express opposition to situations that are harmful, but we don't have to turn that into hatred of the person who's doing harmful things. We just can oppose the, you know, the horrible things, for example, of the recent edict by whoever our president is that that is, you know, sending foreign students to deporting foreign students if they don't attend in-person classes, which is just a despicable edict. Anyway, use the energy of your anger, but you don't have to harbor ill will against the people who give you that opportunity. So,
but yeah, I mean, the white American liberal sense that we shouldn't get angry may be part of what has kept things stuck for so long.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have a little bit of time more. If anybody who hasn't spoken has a comment or question or response for Florence. I don't see any other hands. So Ashley, go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to maybe just do a quick follow-up to David's question, which is kind of turning the leaf on anger. I used to work at a place where they would have quotes along the top of the wall. It was at a rehab. And so, you know, they're inspirational, whatever. And the only one I distinctly remember, it said, and I quote, "I sat with my anger long enough and it showed itself to really be grief." So maybe think about that. Maybe that anger is really about grieving the loss of these innocent people, you know, maybe something like that. So that's kind of a different side that I like to think about when I'm feeling anger, especially in response to maybe, say, my parents. It's probably about grief. So it's something to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. You know, another thing I want to add that I think can be a very, very powerful practice. Actually, I mentioned Darlene Cohen a moment ago. She lived with excruciating pain from severe rheumatoid arthritis for nearly her whole adult life. And she wrote and taught from that place of working with extreme pain. And she developed a way of working with pain called suffering and delight. And a lot of it was about becoming a connoisseur of like your whole range of experience. So part of what pain, anger does is that it contracts us around the singularity of a particular strand of our experience, so that we think we are all anger, or we are all grief, or we are all physical pain. And what Darlene was always teaching is, no, that's happening within a context of a vast stream, a world of sight and sound and smell and hearing. And she would always be looking for where there was pleasure, where there was spaciousness. And so that deep, powerful experience you might be having is not the only thing that's happening. And I think her teachings around pain are really powerful also for working with strong emotion. So I just offer that.
Thank you. We have time for one or two more questions or comments. Anybody?
I've got one. It's Alex.
Alex, hi.
Hi, Alex.
Thank you, Florence, for a really incredible Dharma talk. I don't know if you saw me crying on camera, but you said some things that I really needed to hear, so I appreciate that. And I just wanted to say that I really especially appreciate this talk of, you know, the sort of systemic racism that we live in and that we practice within as a charnel ground. And it really strikes me deeply from my experiences. I'm a chaplain in training, and I did my clinical pastoral education last summer with a group in Chicago called the Night Ministry, where so, you know, we have a bus and we go around with a nurse and a social worker, and we give folks you know, meals and stuff like that. And it was oftentimes an extremely draining experience, an extremely difficult experience to process. But many other times, and especially as the sort of relationships that I had in these places built up, I came to feel very blessed by my ability to have my presence in this space, and, you know, to find these great things in the charnel grounds. And I would often come home feeling like, you know, I was given a lot more than I could have ever given anyone who I, you know, talked to on this given night. So yeah, just thank you. I really appreciated this talk.
Thank you for doing that work. Really profound work and courageous work.
One more comment or question, anyone? Response? Yes, Dylan.
Hi, Lenten. So it's good to hear you.
Hello, Dylan. Oh, you're breaking up a little.
I wanted to see what you thought about. Yeah, I've got a bad audio here. Is this better?
Maybe. Yeah.
Go ahead. Hear you a little.
Okay. Test. I've noticed, particularly amongst white folks, that I think we have a pattern of trying to identify who amongst us is the one that's, you know, made a big public mistake, or has done something taboo or wrong, and then throwing them over into, to the side as marked for life as one of the ones that messed up and that everybody else tries to remain pure over here. And I think that that's a really damaging way of trying to deal with how we move forward about systemic racism. So I don't know if you had any comments about that, if that's how do we collectively examine what's the brokenness we've been given and be accountable at the same time?
Well, that's a profound question. So I think both COVID and systemic racism can evoke some pretty tremendous righteousness, which is actually separating, right? Rather than, I see it in myself. Those people that are like walking down the sidewalk without masks, how could they do that? Just this like thing that rises up in me. That's why I really appreciated Bonnie's first thing about the gusho, right? And maybe Dylan, that's a key, that first section that I read from Bonnie about the gusho, that I got called out, not by a white person, but a person of color, for a really bizarrely stupid thing I said to her. There is no question about it. It was bizarre. And I'm still like, really? I did that? But I know I did that. I remember doing it. Which is just goes to show how deep this stuff goes. And all I could think of was, thank you for having, the courage and willingness to tell me about it, because how else can I see the things I can't see? So that's one kind of gusho, right? So what I would say is the place to pay attention to is not the self-righteousness of others, but the self-righteousness in ourselves. And the defensiveness in ourselves, both of which, and you see it with climate. Oh, that person, you can believe it. They're like flying the Bhutan. What the hell? So it comes up in all of these places. And I think it is actually a form of denial, because if we can make the other worse than us, it gives us a little sense of like having something to stand on rather than being in this groundless space that we're really in. So compassion for yourself when it arises in you, and compassion for others when it arises in them. And that it is not skillful, but it sure seems to be part of the charnel ground right now.
Thank you for the question, Dylan. Thank you very much, Florence.